Wind east at 14, gusting to 22, 42 degrees Kenosha, 40 in Racine, 43 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview is from the Morning Show Archives.
I am exceptionally excited about the next few minutes here on WGTD's Morning Show, where we have interesting conversations day in and day out. But today, our topic is the conversation itself. Specifically, the title of the book, The Art of Conversation, A Guided Tour of a Neglected Pleasure. And that beautifully crafted title gives you some hint of how wonderfully written this book is by Catherine Blythe, a writer and editor who lives in Great Britain. And her work has appeared in all kinds of places there. And she has done superb work here in getting us to think about something which we so easily neglect or take for granted, and particularly in our modern world and in our modern life in which we are surrounded by technologies of every kind, which purportedly make connection with one another easier, but which in some cases can make it still more difficult. We'll explore all that and more over the next few minutes. Again, the book is called The Art of Conversation, A Guided Tour of a Neglected Pleasure. It is published by Gotham Books, and Catherine Blythe, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for that fantastic introduction. I feel like falling completely silent. Anything I say now, you know, how can I measure up to that? But anyway, you've been showing off one of the greatest tools in conversation, and that is flattery. You've made me feel very welcome. Well, so thank you.
Well, I meant every word. I especially love the way you begin this book. I think you make such a good point when you spell out these four simple words, we need to talk. And go on to say, when did this become a threat rather than a statement of fact? Let's talk for a moment about those four words and the connotations they usually bring up for people and what, in fact, we really should mean when we say we need to talk.
Well, exactly. I mean, those words have become shorthand for the death knell of a relationship, because in a weird way, I suppose, when they do arise, if they arise, it's because we're saying we don't communicate anymore. And for me, that illustrates in miniature a wide but slightly overlooked fact, which is that although this is supposed to be the great age of communication, we're so busy in all sorts of ways, not least communicating via machines, that old-fashioned thing, face-to-face talk, is being pushed to the margins of our life. And I think that, you know, if we don't protest, if we don't give this some attention, we're really missing out. I mean, I don't say conversation's lost, but I think it is declining, and if you consider, just count the hours you actually spend in face-to-face conversation, I think you'll be surprised at how much less it is than you'd think. And as far as we need to talk, the statement of fact is true. I mean, we humans are sociable animals. We've been conversing for thousands of years. It's the communication technology that's had more research and development than anything you're likely to find at your local electronics store, and it's incredibly good at what it's designed to do. But of course, unless you learn how to do it, unless you use it, you will lose it.
And you point out quite rightly a little later in the introduction that this is so ironic in this time in world history that's sometimes called the communication age. The irony of this communication age is that we communicate less meaningfully. I guess that's maybe part of the point you're making, is that it is not that we are not communicating with one another, but we are doing so much of our communicating on a different level, and in a sense on what I suppose you would argue is a lesser level.
Well, it's a very thin form of interaction. Just think about it. I mean, the reason I call this book The Art of Conversation and not How to Talk to Anyone is because conversation encompasses the host of skills we have for reading and changing minds. When we talk to someone, when we listen to someone, the opinion we form about what they're saying to us, very little of it, something like 7% apparently, is formed on the basis of the actual words they use. So much of the communication is based on how they appear, their tone of voice, and so on. So if you think about it, to imagine that a text message or an email, however beautifully crafted it might be, is as good as a face-to-face conversation is a bit like saying that the little cross, the kiss at the end of a card or a letter, is as good as a hug. It just isn't. And for me, I mean, there's so much I could say on this. I'll try and limit it. Just think about the amount of information you get from someone else's face. Friendships blossom from the smile that twitches the corner of a mouse. You know, you don't get that instantaneous feed of meaning from text. And the great misconception, most ridiculous one for me, is that people think email is more efficient. Something like 7 out of 10 people in Britain believe that they'd rather send an email to save time. But if you think about it, it's a lot more time consuming, and the chances of being misunderstood because you're not controlling the tone of the voice in which those words are read, is much greater. I think although we think we're having our communication eased by these technologies, a lot of the time we end up serving the technologies that are meant to make our lives more efficient. 10 years ago, I didn't send any emails. Now I spend hours every day, and I'm sure that's the same for most people listening.
Let's circle back for a moment to the title of the book, The Art of Conversation. You've touched on that already, and I think it's interesting at one point when you say conversation remains an art as well as a social duty. Let's talk for a moment again about it, the ways in which conversation is best described as an art versus whatever else we might use to describe it, but also that intriguing notion of it being a social duty.
Well, I suppose the social duty point is easier to encompass. I mean, I've been increasingly surprised, frustrated, shocked, and now no longer shocked because I've looked into the subject, at how often you'll be in a situation where the other person just doesn't volunteer any information, doesn't seem to see it as their duty, that they're waiting for someone else to hold the floor. They may think they're shy. They may feel, you know, crippled with embarrassment, but they don't realize how arrogant, idle, and selfish they seem. And I suppose the larger message of the book is that there are simple ways in which you can acquire greater confidence, and actually this duty is really a pleasure and a great opportunity to enrich your day, be it the hello in the morning to the person serving you coffee, to having the kind of confidence and skills that make you the person who gets the job in the job interview. Going back to the point about conversation as an art, it's quite in a way, it's a kind of contentious one, because to some people that means I'm saying it's a great performance. For me, the word art implies that there are ways you can do it better or worse. And I suppose art rather than skill, because art is something that you can be more freeform with. And again, skill is limited. Art, it encompasses the range of things. I mean, what I really don't want people to take away from this book is the feeling that unless you can spout witty quips like Oscar Wilde, unless you are as amusing and confident as Seinfeld, you're not a great conversationist. Quite the reverse. I'm showing how the art of conversation can come in so many ways. You know, you can be a more creative listener. I have a whole chapter on listening, and for me it's fascinating in itself. You know, what the mental acrobatics that listening encompasses. It's a much more dynamic thing than you might think. And the fact that a great listener can steer conversation, put a little gentle pressure on the rudder, and actually make it a lot more interesting. The fact is that I think people tend to do conversation without thinking, and so they assume that that's the only way to do it well. What I'm trying to get across is that with a little thought, everyone can do so much better, and, you know, positive results in all aspects of their life, really.
And I think what you're also saying here is that to be a good conversationalist can take a lot of different forms. I mean, one does not have to sort of conform to what we might immediately think of as, well, somebody who loves to talk. I mean, you don't have to necessarily be extremely talkative or you don't have to fit any tightly compressed mold. There are a lot of different ways. There is a certain sort of freedom and array of possibilities all within this idea of being a good conversationalist.
I mean, for me, it's the oldest of the human art forms, and it's one that every single human being can be a master of, because ultimately, it's about expressing yourself and having this capacity to open your mind and receive others. I mean, it's not just about the words you say. It's about being able to engage other people's attention, reading and changing minds, all those devious, timeless techniques we humans have developed to get along. And really, I don't know about you, but for me, almost the definition of a bore is someone who talks at me rather than with me. You must have met people who, every time they pause for breath, those rare pauses for breath, you know they're not listening to you. They're just thinking of the next thing to say. Now, for me, that's not an exchange. I mean, the very concept of conversation comes from a Latin word about turning about. It's about taking sides. All those tools for companionship, taking turns and laughing and making other people feel good, building intimacy. Those are the things that matter most. It's not just about florid phrasing. Far from it. I mean, if you approach it as a kind of performance, then you're putting an enormous pressure on yourself, which probably will make you very self-conscious and a bit artificial. And you're losing sight of the fact that when people walk away from a conversation, they're not remembering necessarily the words that were exchanged, but the overall feeling. And the feeling of a good conversation tends to be down to the flow and the harmony, the sense that, you know, think there's been a back and forth, there's been a real connection, and something's been understood. And that's less likely to happen if you're, you know, busy standing on your imaginary podium having a monologue. I mean, I could give an example of a lady at a party recently. My husband was talking to her, and she'd just been to Peru in South America, and she was very enthusiastic, which is great, and that's always a good start to conversation. But she scarcely let him get a word in edgeways. So when he said, oh yes, I've lived in Peru, she didn't even sort of acknowledge that. She just carried on lecturing him about Peru, and you know, every time he tried to make a little connection, she talked over him. So not only did he walk away from this perfectly nice lady thinking, how rude, she really wasn't interested in me, but also he thought she was completely insincere, because she ended up seeming like she was completely phony and uninterested in the very topic that she was lecturing him upon, only because she was neglecting this small, significant thing called listening.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how this kind of poor conversation can take one extreme or the other. I mean, you can either sort of sit there like a sphinx and not reach out in the slightest way to make a connection, or perhaps in a well-meaning effort to make this connection, you ultimately sort of smother or obliterate the other person with all that you have to say, forgetting that there's somebody else that should be part of this conversation.
I know. It's all too easily done. I mean, and this thing of, you know, confidence about reaching out. I mean, this is where, you know, a few simple techniques can help people who feel cramped and tangled up. You know, just remembering that if you focus less on what you've got to say and approach conversation as a kind of treasure hunt, as a quest to find out what interests that other person, and then to find a way to make it relevant to you, to find that point of connection, just that mindset alone will make it a little easier.
Hmm. We're speaking with Catherine Blythe, and we're talking about her wonderful book called The Art of Conversation, A Guided Tour of a Neglected Pleasure. A lot of the book is taken up with techniques and kind of the building blocks of good conversation, and we'll dig into a few of those in just a little bit. I want to stay with this point about the world in which we live now. And you use a word that I've never seen before.
Oh, gosh, that's worrying. I remember it now? Should I grab a dictionary?
It looks to me like gizmogemony.
Oh, yes, that was my invention.
Yes, I love that. Today's gizmogemony alters human experience in a way that trains, planes, automobiles, and even the wheel did not. And you, of course, are talking about some of these electronic tools that we've already mentioned in our conversation that have changed the way we interact. I want to ask you to hone in on that point specifically and tell us the ways in which this is occurring. Maybe in addition to the obvious, which is that the more time we spend emailing, the less time we're spending actually talking to one another. But are there other ways in which this is altering the way we interact with each other in ways that might not be so immediately obvious?
Well, I suppose, there's on the very local level, it's become acceptable for people to be distracted and doing three different things at once, to be texting someone while they're talking to someone. You lose the thread of conversation when something vibrates. But the bigger, when something vibrates in their pocket and they glance away and you're losing that connection. But I suppose that there's a larger fear too, that if we communicate via machines, we end up hiding behind the screens because we lose confidence because, we have to practice conversation. But the really big point, I suppose, is that the texture of what we call a social life is radically altered. I mean, for me, it's just astonishing that someone can genuinely believe they are holding a social life on Facebook. Facebook is a tool. It's a pinboard. It's a way of keeping in touch with what's going on with your friend's life. So it's a useful device. But if someone truly believes that, having 493 friends on Facebook is the same as having 493 friends, counting the notches on the bedpost as opposed to the number of times you had a date with someone, it's sort of wrong. And I suppose it's a kind of voyeurism that's crept into our culture. I mean, if you consider that many people spend a lot of time watching what other people are doing, the celebrity culture, possibly as an audience. I mean, perhaps sometimes it's true of me too. I work alone at home. I listen to the radio and I feel like I've had a conversation and an interaction, when in fact I've just been maybe shouting at the radio or just listening to other people having a conversation. It's this idea that your social life can become something of a spectator sport. And plus, there's this idea that we are constantly connected all the time. I mean, I've withheld the pleasure of a BlackBerry. I don't want one. But I know that if I ever succumb to the BlackBerry, not only will I have this portal of availability dragging around like a ball and chain, so, anyone around the world will feel that they should and can get hold of me at any hour of the day. But not only will I, possibly find my life perforated by this, but also, if I don't constantly have that BlackBerry vibrating, I'll start worrying about it. I mean, I read about people who are addicted to their BlackBerries. They both hate the things, and they're worried that if they didn't have one, they'd be missing out. And I think there are a whole host of different phenomena I'm trying to bundle together, probably rather clumsily here, about how when people start turning their social life into a kind of spectator sport, where it's about a popularity contest, like Facebook, you can end up spending ages kind of constantly monitoring what's going on in other people's lives and feeling left out. I mean, and the darkest story for me in the introduction to my book comes from South Korea, which is, the most wired up country in the world. They have more internet connections than anyone else. Their kids benefit from the best education system in the world. But they've got epidemic social problems. The government's even opened boot camps to send teenagers to learn social skills because they're so busy either at their studies or playing virtual games online that they aren't having a social life. And the trouble is, however intelligent and kind of paper academically articulate they are, they seem to lack the tools for not only expressing their own feelings but reading other people's. And there's the consequences for that emotionally, socially, and for the fabric of family life are quite profound. I think if this is the direction of civilization, it is in a reverse gear. There's a lot that concerns me. I mean, my primary goal is to celebrate and to wake people up to the possibilities of conversation, but to think again about whether you can really have an interaction when you're just shoveling a few words down an electronic phone line. Is that a conversation? Do you end up spending all your time catching up with friends than actually making that extra effort and going and seeing them. I think, especially for people who live in cities, you know, you find yourself growing apart without really noticing.
I think another interesting point you make is that in addition to these kind of electronic communicative conveniences like cell phones and email and Blackberries and so on, that that so much of our modern life is built now around this idea of convenience and of a sort of quick efficiency when it comes to all kinds of things in our in our daily lives. And you say the price of many of our conveniences is the loose change of socializing, that we end up without a lot of the opportunities that we once very naturally had to have these face-to-face encounters with people. Give us a sense of exactly how this happens, or maybe an example or two.
Well, I mean, I grew up in a village, and, you know, I'm not ancient. I'm in my early 30s, but we would go to the grocers, we'd go to the butchers, we'd chat, we'd wait in line, we'd go to the bank, we'd wait in line, you know, and we'd have face-to-face contact. Now, a lot of our electronic commerce means that we spend inhuman proportions of time in kind of mechanized phone situations, waiting to be served and getting rather frustrated. And the other thing, I suppose, is that some of these so-called modern conveniences really aren't convenient. I mean, the great illusion of sending an email is that just by the act of sending an email, we've got something meaningful done. I mean, but in many respects, I think that you'll end up wasting a lot more time trying to work out what someone exactly meant and, you know, constructing the next beautiful sentence only for them to use a word slightly differently from you and misunderstanding to blossom from that. But I do think that lives are much more splintered and separated. I mean, I was appalled to discover, I mean, it's shocking to me that most households in my country have about 3 or 4 television sets, but apparently 40% of children under 4 years old have a TV in their bedroom. I mean, the thing, just those moments of coming together, the old-fashioned convenience of the family meal, which was cheaper, you know, it created a natural forum for conversation to happen. They're not there anymore. And so there is a generation growing up whose parents may have learnt their conversational skills, such as they are, by osmosis, by being told to mind their manners and to, you know, to look into someone's eyes. But if lives are more splintered and we are too busy rushing, trying to catch up with ourselves, if we don't actually spend our lives together, you know, there is, it's, we think we're having a life, but we may be living together apart.
You know, as you are talking about this, you are repeatedly using the word splintered. And
I'm like, oh gosh.
No, it's a great, it's a very apt description of what's going on. But it occurs to me now an interesting connection with another adjective you utilize. When you say, this is towards the end of the book, I don't deny technology makes life more kaleidoscopic. I think that's a really great observation. Of course, you're talking here about how it does add something to our lives. You
of
say,
course.
On the upside, with communication technology, fresh opportunities to make connections abound. I love that I can Twitter to a guy in Albuquerque about Gorgonzola cheese. But then you say, on the downside, it rarely encourages us to prize unalloyed moments together. But, you know, that picture of this technology making life and the world seem more kaleidoscopic, I mean, there's something splintered about a kaleidoscope, too. I mean, it's kind of dazzling, but it isn't
a cohesive. Where do you look? Where is the focus?
Yeah.
And where is the focus? And, of course, that loops back to, you know, the tools for conversation. If you know how to focus people's attention and focus your own, that is how a connection is made. I mean, a visual metaphor for this fragmentary vision of the world and how people's attention is being addressed in a very different way is when you watch a news show on TV. I mean, I don't know whether to look at the ticker tape along the bottom or the weather thing in the corner or the big headline or the forthcoming headline or the clock or the very brightly coloured animated face of the newscaster. I mean, we're being tugged on the sleeve in so many ways. I mean, and I suppose kaleidoscope is a good image in the sense that it's a child's toy. I mean, there is an you know, there is something fun, I guess, about the fact that you can use your iPhone to pretend to drink a pint of beer. You know, someone showed me this on their iPhone. On the other hand, it's just a toy. And the thing about toys is they are distracting, they are entertaining, but it's a kind of short-term pleasure. And I suppose if we're looking to enrich the texture of our life, it's easy to forget that the most enthralling, stimulating encounter you can have isn't with the toy that distracts you. It's that magical moment, however brief and fleeting, when you share a laugh with another person. And you're less likely to do it if you're busy scratching away at your iPod and, you know, shutting yourself down from this pressing world. I think we're turning inwards, even as in theory we're connected. The global village idea, I think, was, you know, unduly optimistic. It's more like the global shopping mall, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Catherine Blythe. We are talking about her book, The Art of Conversation, A Guided Tour of a Neglected Pleasure. Tell us what guided you in putting this book together the way that you did, and in particular, breaking down the art of conversation into various components that we otherwise might not maybe think enough about or fully appreciate. What were you after in going after the topic in the way that you did?
Well, I suppose I was trying to achieve a lot of things. I wanted to break conversation down in a way that was instructive, but full of fun stories, and just illustrated that conversation isn't just about the words you say. How did I arrive at that structure? I mean, to an extent, I wanted to mirror the structure of how a conversation deepens, but that, you know, topic by topic, that argument slightly slips away. At the beginning, it's all about greetings, and for me, that's fascinating. It's fascinating to look at how greetings work around the world and what important gatekeepers they are. And then I build up into small talk and looking at why small talk, which is something that, you know, some financial directors in a survey said that small talk with clients was the most difficult thing in their job. And I wanted to look at why small talk is a big deal. And then I build up looking at listening and topics, and then it broadens out a bit. I'm slightly dodging your question here, because I struggle to find exactly the right approach. And for me, it was just those thematic arresting headings. I mean, looking at humour as an isolated topic was quite tough, because that touches on other elements. But, you know, it repays study, especially the tips and techniques of other comedians. And lying, something very overlooked, or something that automatically makes people bristle. But I wanted to highlight that, you know, tact is a great social skill, and directness, which is all too prized, particularly on some of the more violent things that call themselves talk shows. You know, we love the entertainment of watching people shouting at each other, but directness, it isn't our right. It's the privilege of intimacy. So I just wanted to, you know, be a bit provocative, make people laugh, and actually scrutinize these the details that stitch aspects of conversational social skills together in a lively way. Shut up shop, for me, that's a later chapter for when you're at the end of your tether with a difficult person and want to get rid of them. And that, for me, is a bit of an opportunity to quote some great put downs and to, you know, remind people that if you want to win a verbal battle, you don't just fight and fight and fight. I don't know. There's so much in it. It was really tough. I mean, I don't know. I can't answer your question fully, in that I sort of found my structure as I was going along, and these segments presented themselves to me.
I think it works really well because, for one thing, it in a sense sort of celebrates the wonderful complexity and endless possibilities and potential that are part of good conversation, and that if it were, in a sense, too cut and dried and cohesive, we wouldn't be left with that same sense. It would feel more like a book about something much more cut and dried, like, I don't know, chemistry or something. But, I mean,
yeah,
conversation is something that is sort of outside of the lines by its very nature, because you have two human beings engaged in something that by its nature is going to be, to at least some extent, unpredictable and full of possibilities.
And that's what I want to relish. I mean, I am trying to, you know, I wanted, as I was writing it, you know, for me, the bar was, does this thing make me laugh? Does this story surprise me? And does it make a good point? You know, to celebrate conversation as well as elucidate it, the mechanics of it, you have to look at how people have spoken. The wonderful thing about researching it for me was that, you know, literally anything was on limits. You know, how did Elizabeth the First shut up her courtiers? Well, that's as useful for me to know as it is to look at how George Bush kind of shook hands rather curiously with Barack Obama by first anointing his palm with an antiseptic. You know, I wanted funny stories that illustrated these points well and somehow to kind of get people to stand back and look how much of the richness of human encounter has occurred face to face. You know, this larger message that, you know, it's slipping away from us, possibly, without us really noticing.
I want to circle back to the chapter called Small Talk, Big Deal, because I think you are so correct in that a lot of people feel like this is sort of, in a sense, the bane of their existence, that having to engage in what we call small talk or chit-chat with somebody is just something that has no point, it has no purpose, it's not easy, you can't wait till it's over, and in fact, you tell us that this can be so useful, so valuable, so enjoyable. I mean, it is worth doing, and it's worth doing well. And I want to ask you to expand on a couple of the interesting points that you make. One of the things you say is that we should approach small talk as though it is a treasure hunt. Tell us what you mean by that intriguing image.
Okay, well, I think one of the major problems people have with small talk, although they won't necessarily admit it, is that the trouble is when you're less invested in the topic, if you don't know the other person that well, then you're much more self-conscious. You're putting this tremendous performance pressure on you, which makes conversation daunting and it makes it a chore. So one of the ways I wanted to turn that around was rather than be self-conscious, look at how you can be conscious of the other person. To approach small talk as a treasure hunt for me is about, you know, coming a little bit prepared and coming with that spirit of adventure, realizing that every encounter can be an adventure with another mind. And there are a few techniques for doing that. I mean, obviously coming prepared with a couple of things you want to say is one of them. And also how you speak, you know, scattering potential topics like bait, you know, like breadcrumbs on the water, and then watching for what lights up that other person's face and then taking the opportunity to dig deeper. That's a kind of practical approach for doing something that I think is essential in any conversation. That's finding your incentive to talk. You know, my motto is that the shortest route to an interesting conversation is to find out what interests them and then make it relevant to you. I mean, going back to the larger point about how small talk can change your life, I mean, not only can it make glancing encounters more pleasant, and it's true, if you just have a few trivial little happy encounters, your mood will be instantly boosted because we're social animals, we're designed for this stuff. But small talk also opens us up to the possibilities of encounter, and Malcolm Gladwell talks about this very eloquently in his great best-selling book, The Tipping Point, how social acquaintances, unlike good friends, widen our world. They're much more likely to be able to put you in touch with that contact. Possibly they're a step away from the love of your life or that great job. You know, if you're open to the serendipity of a light encounter, not only are you going to achieve greater social confidence, but you are widening your world in a significant way. The most important thing, I suppose, is to approach it with an open mind, to not think, oh gosh, how dreary, but oh, who will I meet today?
You know, I can think of so many real-life examples of this because I happen to be someone who doesn't really struggle with this, but I know most people do. I think of the last time I was at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. And
oh,
I was taking a former student of mine who was attending the Met for the very first time in his life.
Wow.
And I engaged in conversation with the woman next to me, and he in turn turned to the couple that was to his right, and engaged very easily in conversation. And it turns out that this couple used to live where we live 30 years ago, but, you know, in the middle of Wisconsin. And here we are in the middle of New York City, in the middle of the Metropolitan Opera. And that wonderful little discovery, amazing discovery, would not have been possible if he and I had just sat there sort of rigidly talking to one another and excluding those who were on either side of us.
And it makes you tingle with happiness. It's just, it's so strange. I mean, and that brings into focus the other thing, of course, conversation. It's all about any conversation, little or large, is about building relationships, about finding common ground. And as you point out there, I mean, we have so much more in common with the people around us than we think. And if we approach it with enthusiasm and an open mind and really relish it, you know, we benefit from the contagiousness of a good mood. Sorry, I'm getting random segue. I was very excited to read a New Scientist latest issue. There have been all these studies about social influence and how if your friends are happy, you're much more likely to be happy. I mean, it sums up to me the kind of big argument of the book that it's not just about your self-esteem, but kind of social esteem. If you're in an environment like that, sitting in the row, happily having a comfortable conversation with a complete stranger, it does turn up the lights brighter. It makes this world a better place. And, you know, we're going into a new frightening year in many ways. But if we can relish the possibilities to enrich our lives in such a simple way, we will be better armed to enjoy it and survive the challenges ahead.
Absolutely. We should mention that this chapter, like others, has all kinds of tangible suggestions on the ways to do this well. I mean, something like chit-chat or small talk. And I find it interesting that in this case, for instance, one of your first suggestions is start in neutral. Meaning, of course, be a little bit cautious. I mean, don't have your opening salvo be, you know, something about President so-and-so is a demon or...
Yes.
But by the time we get to the end of your list of suggestions, you're telling us to tickle boundaries. That is, at some point, it becomes possible to think beyond the safe middle road.
Well, I suppose it's this thing, the idea of common ground. So you're kind of mapping your shared territory at the beginning. So that's why it's worth being in neutral. And then tickling those boundaries, I suppose it's all about building up intimacy. I talk in, there's a phrase I use about the ladder of intimacy has four steps, and how in an encounter with a stranger in particular, you know, there are ways to escalate the intimacy. You can't just go from 0 to 60. You have to first have the greeting and then share some facts, you know, about where you are. Maybe then you make an observation about the music, perhaps, you know, it's a little loud. And then once you've shared your opinions, then you can trade your feelings. Because there are three different ways of being polite. There's, you know, being deferential and formal is one of them. And instant camaraderie, we like to think that by treating someone as a best friend, they'll automatically be our best friend. But if you don't just respect that, you know, the gradations, you're kind of trespassing on their personal territory. So it's just, I wanted to highlight how gentle those steps are and how you're sending out signals in how you structure your sentences, which makes it sound much more self-conscious, and I hope it comes across in the book.
Yeah, it's such a good thing for us to be aware of. For instance, you say, build talk up to scale. You say turn observations into discussion points by tagging on a question. For example, it's a beautiful evening, isn't it? And just by adding those last two words, isn't it? It's kind of an implied question which really invites more than just a yup.
Yes, exactly. You've got to be inclusive. I mean, when people are rushing to make an impression, they often make these kind of strident statements, the generalizations. But what they're losing sight of is that unless you kind of stitch, you know, opportunities for the other person to say something more than yup into your conversation, then yup is what you're likely to get. Or alternatively, another pompous generalization from them. I mean, just how if we are more detailed and more observational, we are opening up more possible topics for them to build on. And similarly, when you're listening to someone talking, if they, you know, even if they're on a subject that maybe not your cup of tea, I mean, I give the example of when I was talking to a guy he for some reason was determined to tell me. I presume it was code for him telling me how rich he was. He really wanted me to know about his weakness for fast Italian cars. And I don't drive. I'm not that into cars. And I felt that he was trying to impress me in a particular way. And this was a while ago, and I was a little bit lazy. I just went, oh, really? Oh, really? And didn't encourage him very much. But nor did I take charge and use the valuable tool of focusing his attention on something I'd like to talk about. And this time around, if I was to meet him, rather than just go, really, when he said, oh, it could drive this fast, I said, oh, really? Where can you drive that fast? And I gently coax him onto another subject. I mean, it's just one example of how listening, a bit of creative interruption, can stitch the connections closer and make for a more harmonious encounter. Because, you know, it's all too easy to sit back and think, right, this is boring. But in fact, boredom is so often a failure of imaginative hospitality.
And I just want to encourage
people to think about it. Sorry, am I getting ahead of you?
No, not at all. Well, in a way, I guess, but that's fine. You just quoted something that I wanted to quote as well. I love image in the chapter, Pay Heed, where you say, good listeners share a virtue of imaginative hospitality. I think that's a wonderful expression. Can you just say another word about what you mean by that?
Well, I suppose, you know, it's that simple, straightforward thing. If we want to have an encounter, we have to open our minds. And that means that, you know, rather than just preparing the words to say, if you're actually giving the person the benefit of the doubt, holding their words up to your imagination, you will find a connection. I mean, we all have 1,001 things in common just by virtue of breathing and seeing and eating. But if we don't make that small step, giving our attention, showing interest, and, you know, showing the other person that we're listening to them too, you know, by nodding and smiling and saying yes and just, you know, making a bit more of an active effort, then our boredom will not only be obvious, but it will discourage them and make it absolutely certain that this will be an unsuccessful and depressing encounter.
It's intriguing to me that one of your chapters is devoted to silence and the fact that there is a place for silence in good conversation, and that there are even many different kinds of silence, or silence can be caused by all kinds of different things.
Yes.
And it is not just the awkward pause that we wish would go away, but there are all kinds of ways in which silence can actually be quite a meaningful tool.
Yes, very useful. I mean, I'll never forget, there was the late lamented literary agent Pat Kavanagh, who married to Julian Barnes, the novelist, who died recently, and I remember dealing with her, and she was an absolute master of silence. I mean, in her case, it was an exceptionally useful tool for negotiation, because you'd be so embarrassed by the silence, you'd end up giving away too much information, or maybe even upping your offer for a book. I think overall, culturally, we are, you know, slightly frightened by silence. Maybe that's because there's so much other extraneous noise, but you can get yourself into tremendous trouble if you never pause for breath. And you're also losing sight of the fact that a pause can seize your listener's attention rather powerfully. It can make words resonate louder. I mean, stand-up comics have this great phrase, never step on your punchline. What they mean is pause before you give that laugh. And in some ways, you're actually preparing your audience's mind for a laugh. It grabs us. I mean, I have a tendency now on the radio, I'm bubbling with enthusiasm. You talk too quickly. It's harder to listen to. So that's one of the many instances in which, you know, bearing silence in mind can help you communicate rather better.
You just touched on the matter of humor, and I think one of the most interesting points made in your chapter called Wit to Woo, where you talk about the role of humor in conversation, is humor melts barriers. And I think that is an aspect of humor that we don't often think about. And of course, humor misused can do just the opposite.
Mm.
But it certainly has that potential when we use humor well. And also, let humor shift the temperature. That is also an intriguing possibility.
Well, I think I mean, studies find that 8 out of 10 incidents of laughter in a conversation, I mean, some scientists actually stood around measuring this, eavesdropping on conversation. 8 out of 10 times, the laughter was not prompted by a witticism or humour at all. It was to do with someone new entering the conversation or saying goodbye or saying, oh, it was great talking to you, and that would be punctuated by a laugh. And what that highlights for me is that laughter is a kind of form of social punctuation, and we use it in so many different ways. You know, if there's an awkward moment, if people laugh, that sort of punctures a hole in that awkward mood and everyone can relax again. So I just wanted to, you know, look at how we can increase the opportunities for laughter. And again, it's quite surprising to me, but when you think about it, it's undeniable. You know, if you stand a little closer to someone, they're more likely to laugh. If you're with a friend and you're telling them a joke, you will laugh at that joke, despite what they say. It's actually a good thing to do because it includes us in the mood. And just the overall point, I suppose, about laughter, I mean, there's no surer sign of a moment shared that you're connecting with someone than laughing together.
Let's finish up with, I think, what is really often frightening and intimidating for people, and that is, what can we talk about? The whole idea of what is a good topic of conversation or subject of conversation, and you devote an entire chapter to what I think is a really important point. I want to ask you especially about your second rule in this chapter, when you say topics are unstable mixtures of attitude and subject.
Yes. I mean, a topic isn't just a kind of abstract noun with a capital letter. You know, it's not just politics or war or religion or love. It is, a topic is that live animal that you both are chasing. So a good topic of conversation can't just be measured by some sort of, you know, rubric in a textbook. It has to be to do with the mood and the attitude of the people in it. So whether or not something makes a fit subject really depends on how much, you know, dynamism it's generating. So I look at different topics, that some which are considered terrible and some which are gaining popularity, like money, and just try and highlight to people how, you know, presentation of a topic can close it down, its talkability, and also what some of the risks are. I mean, the great cliche for English conversation is that we all talk about the weather. And while some people think that's incredibly dull, I like to point out that, you know, that has the wonderful virtue of accessibility. You know, it's a topic that instantly you can both share. And that being qualified to talk about it is the primary, you know, qualification of a topic. If you're an expert on umbrellas, but I've never seen the rain, never mind held an umbrella in my hand, that ain't going to be a good topic of conversation.
You also point out in this chapter that we have to be careful about the stories we tell, for instance, about how wonderful our children are or great accomplishments. And I think this line's one of the best in the books. Litanies and lists do not a tale make. Keep a long story short to make the pleasure mutual. But probably a lot of us reach a little too quickly for litanies and lists when it comes to trying to fill a space or a silence with conversation.
I know. That's where a little pause for thought, you know, why am I telling this person this, can make all the difference. I know I can slip into that mode. You know, what did you do on holiday? And if you go into a great catalogue of where you went, it's no good at all. I mean, you just have to, just seizing on the thing that happened that was funny and meaningful can, you know, it's the difference between someone telling you how brilliantly brainy their daughter is and the funny story that happened when she went to her French exam. You know, those stories are what connect us. They're what get people's attention. And that's all I have to say. I'm listing my points now. I better stop.
I want to finish with the last paragraph of the book from the chapter, Are You Receiving Me? You say, of all arts, the oldest and most captivating, it is also the easiest, free to all. As prices soar and time shrinks and space compacts, it is one luxury that costs nothing. We're talking, of course, about conversation and the book, The Art of Conversation, A Guided Tour of a Neglected Pleasure, published by Gotham Books and the author, Catherine Blythe. Catherine Blythe, I have so enjoyed this and so enjoyed your book, and I know many people will, and I'm glad we could talk.
It's been a real privilege talking to you. Can I just add that I have a website. If anyone would like to share their questions, dilemmas, or funny stories about conversation, I'd love to hear from people.
And
www.catherineblythe.com.